Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, March 6, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, our weekly take on the performance of the news media, and it comes to you from the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism. I'm Mike McKean, director of the RJI Futures Lab. Here with me are Views regulars and J-School colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. On our program this week, News Corp thinks there's room for another cable sports network. We'll know soon when the company launches Fox Sports One. Conservative media and conservative journalism are in the spotlight because of their recent coverage of the Chuck Hagel nomination. Bob Woodward says the White House threatened him over his story about the across-the-board budget cuts, but how worried was he really? And Berkshire Hathaway billionaire Warren Buffett is betting big on newspapers, but not on the ones with names most of us know. Let's start with yesterday's announcement that Rupert Murdoch's News Corp is finally making good on a long-term goal of launching a national sports cable network. They'll do it this fall, and it's going to be called Fox Sports One. Well, Charles, why sports and why now for Fox?
I think there was a song back in the 70s, Money, Money, Money. There's still money to be made in sports. I mean, if you look at it, and I think some of the coverage points this out, ESPN has occupied the high ground. The networks, I would argue, have occupied the medium ground, but there's still the valley. And in the valley, there's all sorts of opportunities. When you're talking about midweek Major League Baseball games, minor NASCAR events, off-brand golf tournaments, there's still a lot of stuff that's not televised. As a rabid sports fan, I can attest to the fact that we're reaching the point where every Mizzou basketball game is on television, but no Mizzou baseball game is on television, for example. The same analogy can be applied to all of the professional sports, some, not all, and, well, with the exception of the NFL.
Well, Lee, you're probably less rabid than – almost all of us are less rabid sports fans than Charles, but yes. Does this make sense for Fox to go into sports broadcasting full-time?
Actually, keeping in mind that I want a ballet page, not a sports page – I'm stunned that it's taken this long. I really am, because every study of media economics of any kind, whether it's newspaper, TV, whatever, shows that your most tightly niched group that is most willing to pay for particular content are people who are sports fans. So it actually in some ways surprises me that Fox hasn't made this move and this move earlier. I think the other thing is that some big sporting events – may have become far too expensive for the networks to spend the kind of dough that they've been spending to televise them. So I think as the networks pull back for economic reasons, Fox is going to come in and try to recoup some of those events at a somewhat lesser price. And that seems smart to me as well.
Yeah, it seems to me, Charles, that maybe one of the less obvious reasons for folks who don't follow, you know, new media or the competition between broadcasters and the internet these days is that live programming of any kind, but especially live sports broadcasts lead to less avoidance of advertising, and that's why the money is so important.
Precisely. And it's a big money game going in because you've got to negotiate for broadcast rights. So you're spending big money up front to make bigger money in the back. That's been the formula. I think it'll be interesting to see if Fox takes a different tactic, which is go for the low-hanging fruit. The things where the broadcast rights are not going to be that expensive, especially if they marry it to the demographic of Fox already. If they take sort of the Fox News demographic and they marry it to, I don't know, the Bassmaster Classic and hunting shows, man, I think you're stacking your demographics really beautifully there. And there's all kinds of opportunities to do that kind of programming.
Well, and the other demographic that Fox has is not on its news, but on its entertainment networks, and that skews far younger. So look at all the extreme sports that have various meets of various sorts that aren't contracted right now, but a lot of younger people will wanna watch those in a more or less. What I want to say, on a more or less regular basis.
Well, and I think too, Charles, I mean, let's not conflate Fox News or even entertainment audiences with Fox Sports. They have a lot of audience out there already. They have NASCAR. They have Major League Baseball. They have rights to all kinds of regional sports networks. So it's not like they're coming in here with nothing on the table already. They've got a strong stable of programs.
No, I mean, the Fox News analogy I make is that Fox News has gotten really good at plumbing that whole American apple pie, screaming eagle stuff. That's where the opportunity is in sports as well. The lower rung, you know, you've got NASCAR on the big networks, but there are 15 racing leagues in addition to NASCAR that racing fans are crazy about and is not on television at all. You can't, I mean, I guess you can go to like the racing network a la carte cable channel and find some of it, but you're not going to find a lot of it. Day two of the Dubai Open, you're not going to find on television. Day three of the Dubai Open, it's waiting to be plucked up, and it's relatively inexpensive fare.
Well, and for that matter, Fox owns the rights to a sport, which in this country is not all that popular at the moment, but in the rest of the world is hugely popular, soccer. I mean, they have access to, you know, World Cup soccer and FIFA. They've got all of that in the bag, so if they can get an American audience to watch that, I mean, they don't have to compete with ESPN or anybody else to do that. And speaking of competing with ESPN, Lee, a lot of the people writing about this today are making that comparison. Does Fox Sports have to compete successfully with ESPN, or is there room there without having to go head-to-head with them?
I agree with what Charles says. I think there's a lot of room where they won't have to go head-to-head. I do think that ESPN in some ways has got the high ground, but it's been expensive high ground. And I think Fox can come in and, I mean, this has been their formula. It doesn't matter whether it's news or entertainment. They come in, they provide something that's edgier, they skew it younger, they do it far more inexpensively, and they build audience. And I just can't see that formula not working here.
So Charles, let's talk a little bit about ESPN. I mean, what have they done over the past 30 years that has made them such a juggernaut? Why are they so hard for anybody to go up against?
Oh, they're the masters of cross-promotion and horizontal integration. They buy up properties to the left and right of them, and they just take over entire segments of the sporting industry. So now you've got, what, 8 cable channels, I think, at this point? ESPN 1, 2, and 3, Classic, News,
Women.
You.
Yeah.
So they go into markets, flood the zone, to use a sports term, by throwing money at it. Meanwhile, reaping all of the profits from really two things. One, the sporting news franchise that they started with, but original sports programming, which they moved into more recently, but way more aggressively in recent years. It's been kind of interesting to watch ESPN over the years, because they used to, in their earliest days, do nothing but show really obscure programming. It used to be the place to go for Australian rules football live broadcast. Now you go to ESPN and you see nothing but Division I basketball and football and professional sport. So in a way, all of that content, which you would think they would just repurpose to other channels, it's just not on anymore.
And they not only cover, but they own the most popular franchise for extreme sports, which is the X Games. I mean, it's not just that they cover it, it's theirs. It's the X Games belongs to ESPN.
It is a brilliant behemoth. I think the story that we put up said they're making $8.5 billion a year in revenue now. And by the way, for our listeners, it was really the brainchild of a Mizzou Journalism School alum. And a former city editor over at the Columbia, Missouri.
And, you know, one of the reasons they're making that much money, Lee, is because not only can they charge, you know, advertisers to advertise on all these channels that Charles mentions, but they get by far the highest subscription revenue on cable of anybody, about $5 and change from every single subscriber. Even Fox, which is coming in with this new sports channel, hopes they can charge $1 per subscriber.
one of the things I learned that blew me away, okay, again, keep in mind, this is the lady who wants the ballet page, is that approximately 35% of newspaper readers read nothing but the sports section. It's kind of, it's what I do in reverse. I take the news section, I hand the sports section to my husband or to the recycle bin. Most people don't do it that way. And so I think that, that's what Fox is counting on, and I think that's really smart.
So we have, Charles, a variety of other cable sort of second tier properties in sports that are already out there. CBS just launched one. NBC just launched one. Some of the sports themselves, NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, they have their own channels. The Big Ten has one. Pac-12 has one. The SEC is about to start its own channel. So what does Fox have going for them that makes them think they can, you know, ease their way into that and suddenly be number two or three or whatever in that universe?
Well, they've got the infrastructure in that, as you alluded to earlier, they have been covering and originating sports programming for many years. So when it comes to taking a sport, let's say it's – I keep going back to the Bassmaster Classic. I got bass on my mind right now, and there's a lot of coverage of it as a fishing tournament, believe it or not. ESPN dabbles, sorry for the pun, but they dabble in that water a little bit. You know, maybe every Saturday, fifth Saturday in the summer, they'll show 2 hours. Those things last for 4 days, believe it or not, 4 days of fishing. There are people who would watch 3 days of it and, like, put toothpicks in their eyelids to stay awake and watch it. That's the kind of thing a Fox can really go out and militarize around and do a fantastic 3-day package on, because they have the wherewithal already technologically and personnel-wise to do that.
There's clearly an upside for professional and college sports, because if Fox succeeds as another competitor, they're going to drive up the price of negotiating these rights for these teams. But consumers are probably going to pay, because our cable bills are going up, unless someday the cable companies have enough competition themselves to where they have to offer a la carte or channel-by-channel programming. Lee, I think it's ironic, too, that one of News Corp's earlier plans for a sports network actually revolved around Keith Olbermann. And as it turns out, now there is talk, in the New York Times at least, that Olbermann is trying very hard to negotiate with ESPN to come back on board there. And I just wonder, given the bad terms with which he's left every job he's ever had in the past 20 years, whether it's ESPN, Fox, MSNBC, Current TV, whom he's suing right now for like 50 or 60 million bucks or whatever, why would anybody in their right mind sign on for that kind of abuse?
Because they think he's going to drive up ratings and he's going to make them money. I mean, I don't know Mr. Olbermann, so I have no idea what kind of a human being he is or what he's like to work with. But this is television, and essentially one thing counts, and that's, are your numbers better than your competition? And unfortunately, are your numbers better this week than they were last?
I thought it was interesting, Charles, in one of the pieces on our blog, an ESPN editor is quoted as basically saying, if they ever bring Keith Olbermann back into ESPN, the first thing they ought to do is line him up and let us all come through and punch him in the stomach. So that tells you a little something about how well he's liked among some of the folks there.
Wow.
Well, part of the strategy, of course, at News Corp has been to split the company, as we've been talking about the past several months. And they're about to do it. There's a newspaper division only. And then all of the other broadcast and movie properties are going into the other company. And I assume, well, and Fox Sports One is going to be part of that much more, I assume, lucrative broadcast half of News Corp. So what does that say about the economies of newspapers, everybody put over in their little division, and all the attention's being focused on
that's really broadcast. Interesting, and maybe the one is being used to prop up the other, I guess. I mean, that is, in many ways, the model out there. If you look at smaller media empires, below Media General, they'll take the television outlets and put them on one side and the print on the other. Now, historically, that was done, I think, for journalistic reasons, to kind of make sure there were print journalists and broadcast journalists, and they had a different ethos, right? Then we went through that sort of convergence period where everybody was going to run one unified desk. But from an operations standpoint, I think these days it really makes a lot of sense for Murdoch to sort of separate that print thing out. It also has a whole heck of a lot to do, I would imagine, from the liabilities that continue to swirl around the UK eavesdropping stuff.
Well, Lee, while News Corp is walling off its newspapers and a lot of other newspapers are hemorrhaging readers, why is it that Omaha billionaire Warren Buffett, who's a shrewd money guy if ever there was one, is doubling down on his recent newspaper investments? On Friday, for example, they put out a letter that he sent to people who have shares in Berkshire Hathaway explaining that not only is he going to keep buying newspapers, some newspapers, but that he actually loves newspapers.
Well, he may love newspapers, but I don't think it's for the reasons that the three of us may love newspapers. We have a visitor this week, Robert Picard, who's a very distinguished media economist. And in a talk he gave yesterday, he explained that, you know, Warren Buffett is smart like a fox. He buys properties that he thinks are undervalued. The newspapers that Buffett is buying are not the New York Times, not the Washington Post. It's smaller newspapers that he believes are undervalued. They're very profitable already. When you consider normal profit now is somewhere 2%, and some of his properties are making 17. So they're very undervalued. They're very profitable in that way. And essentially what Dr. Picard thinks is going to happen is he's going to hold on to them until they become less undervalued, at which point he will sell them, which is his pattern, and he will have made a boatload of money.
But at least for the short term, Charles. I mean, it's not just that those newspapers that he's buying are undervalued, but he's going strictly for the small and medium market papers because he believes, he says, that they're more connected to the community and there are things they can do in terms of having a more unified community base than a large market newspaper can.
Yeah, in one of those stories, I think it was Rim Ryder's column in the Washington Post, in which he spoke with Mr. Buffett on the phone, and I think he used the word indispensable. He's looking for newspaper properties that are indispensable to their communities, and he's found this point between really small town papers that probably have no allure for him because their price tag is so small, and really big papers in which he has no interest, and he made it abundantly clear. In fact, when he bought the Media General papers and passed on the Tampa Tribune, that was probably as clear a signal as any that he was not getting in the urban journalism market at all.
Well, and as he said, he doesn't believe that an urban market like that actually has a community. It has many communities of interest all in one geographical area, but with a smaller town and a smaller paper, it is a more homogenous community, and things like local sports can actually be covered well. There is a community around which you can generate a conversation, Lee.
Well, there's a community around which you can generate a conversation, and there's a community that advertisers want to reach. One of the things we're sort of learning about media economics is that urban newspapers are a really bad way to reach lots of readers and lots of advertisers because urban areas have more niches and there are more different communities. It's not a singular community, but a community. Warren Buffett is not going to buy the Columbia Tribune. Please don't misinterpret. But a community like Columbia that is more homogenous, that has an audience that looks for sort of the same thing regardless of social class or regardless of ethnicity or education. That's the kind of paper where I think he sees that it's indispensable to the community and hence it's capable of making money for advertisers.
Well, it's worth noting this is a guy that about 4 years ago, he famously said, I would buy a newspaper at any price. During this last interview with Rim Ryder, he said something like, I shouldn't have said at any price because they finally reached a price that is so low that it attracted me. The other thing to keep in mind is he's not just buying these sort of democracy-saving assets of a daily newspaper, which I love, mind you, but he's also buying real estate, production plants, newspaper buildings. Those are fixed assets, and they're very valuable assets. And as the underlying assets inside of them diminishes, he's still, I think, making a calculated bet that if the whole thing goes south, he still has something valuable at the end.
And yet, at least in his public or semi-public justification for buying up these newspapers, he's telling his investors he thinks that the strategy of paywalls, of charging more for online content, can actually work. Now, you mentioned our colleague Robert Picard, who's been here this past week. He gave a similar sort of analysis as Buffett did, but it seemed to me he was a heck of a lot more skeptical about either subscriber revenue or advertising ever bringing newspapers back to any even semblance of their heyday.
Well, at least if I understood Robert correctly, and I'm not 100% sure that I did, but one of the things that he said that struck me is he thinks that there is a core audience for news out there that's about 25% of the people, and that essentially what newspapers need to do to save themselves is to find a way to reach that core audience with content, both advertising and news coverage. If that's true, that's more sophisticated content, it's different kinds of journalism, it's all the sorts of things that we're beginning to learn to be able to throw at readers of a certain ilk. It doesn't speak to the larger issues about what happens to the other 75%, particularly in a democratic society.
It also says nothing about the next generation and the generation following it. When Mr. Buffett, somewhere in that column, said, "What I'm really trying to do is slow the erosion of print," that quote sort of terrified me. Because I don't think any one man, no matter how brilliant and how wealthy, can slow the erosion of print. That's a cultural phenomenon, not even an economic phenomenon. It's bigger than all of us. The next generation is going to engage with a print newspaper almost never. And I don't think there's anything to be done with magical to the content or the pricing that is going to reverse that.
Well, so one of our big market newspapers, although they were focusing on online content this week, the Washington Post announced, Lee, that they're jumping on the bandwagon of so-called sponsored content or native advertising. They're going to have even their own team of people who are going to be there to help marketers get content on their homepage and on other pages in prominent places. Now, we talked about this with that Atlantic scandal around Scientology a few weeks ago. What do you make of the Post going in that direction?
Okay, every once in a while, the Washington Post just dumbfounds me with what it does. So I'm dumbfounded, which may also mean that I'm dumb. I mean, we can just take the founded part off. I read the Washington Post every day online, and I already get a lot of advertising revenue, or I already get a lot of ads as part of that content. So what else they're going to do until they so degrade my reading experience that I'm no longer going to be willing to participate? I honestly don't know, but I'm sort of wondering how far they're going to push me and my little envelope here.
I may have missed it, but I didn't see the Post, at least so far, come out with a set of guidelines as the Atlantic did when they ran into trouble. And those guidelines actually were fairly defensible professionally and ethically. So it'll be interesting to see if the Post feels a need to do that. Well, some of the biggest media conglomerates, Charles, did have something to cheer about yesterday. Disney, Time Warner, News Corp, Viacom, CBS, all of them shared in the record high stock prices that were reflected in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And Jon Stewart was quick to note the irony last night on The Daily Show.
The Dow Jones Industrials at never-before-seen heights.
All-time record high.
Making history today.
If they tell you everything's awful, tell them, no, it's not.
It's a March miracle. The non-inflation adjusted values of the stocks of 30 large companies that sort of tracked the American economy 50 years ago are higher than ever. We're back, baby.
And the best part is we never had to fix our systemic issues.
It just got better.
It brings us to our new segment. I guess that's one problem we never have to worry about again.
Lee Stewart has a point, doesn't he? At least some government and business and media types were offering some less than skeptical takes on yesterday's stock market.
Oh my goodness. It's as if we have amnesia. 2008 really never happened. I mean, this is a place where Stewart is saying in a humorous way something that I think is really, really important, because yes, the Dow is up, and so some people on paper are perhaps better off, or at least as well off as they were in 2008. I wish there was a similar index for unemployment and underemployment and people who are going to have to work until they're 95 and a half in order to be able to pay for their medical care and everything else that they're going to need.
Tom's had a great story. I think it was Monday before we hit that big benchmark, in which it was right on the front there, and it said something like higher corporate profits give, I mean, the thesis was higher corporate profits are giving corporate America a reason not to do anything about employing more American workers. Mm-hmm. And it's a head-scratching conundrum of a story, and one which the collective broadcast media, seeing a shiny bauble called a benchmark, just ran right past on their way to that cheerleading. I always love, though, the way the media is accused of being such Bolsheviks. And there we are, you know, dancing the happy dance.
Oh, we are very good capitalists.
Well, we've also seen this past week some, shall we say, less than nuanced or, for that matter, just plain wrong reporting from some of the country's conservative media. Well, the most obvious one people have pointed to before this past week was Fox News insisting during its election night coverage, right up to and even after the results were coming in, that somehow Mitt Romney was going to pull out a victory. But we've had some more recent examples, and they're on a post on our blog. For example, all the conservative outlets that were running stories the past couple of weeks suggesting that Chuck Hagel was not going to be going to win nomination as Secretary of Defense, or that he'd talked to some group called Friends of Hamas when there really wasn't any proof that that ever happened. Tucker Carlson has been running these stories saying that New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez was cavorting with prostitutes, and now there have been some other journalists who've said, no, wait a minute, that may not have happened after all. So, I mean, no one's going to accuse either one of you of being giant supporters of conservative media, but even those folks who are, you know, are kind of worried about what these outlets are doing to some of the more intelligent arguments from the right.
Well, in fact, no, I am no fan of conservative media, but not for ideological reasons, for reasons that we're finally getting to, and that is it doesn't work very well. I could care less if there's a conservative news media, so long as it adheres to some standards and principles that the rest of the news media adhere to. It's been, for the longest time, an information propaganda ministry. I wondered when we were going to reach this point, when the train ran completely off the tracks and they looked at the smoldering pile of wreckage and went, yeah, we got to fix our processes in a way to get this stuff right more often. Yeah. That Atlantic Monthly takedown that you put up on the blog, which I cannot recommend highly enough. It is just brutal in its efficiency. And there's a line in it in which he says something to the effect of the conservative blogosphere, the conservative information complex, wants to do journalism through the lens of what we want the world to be. Journalism requires that we tell the world as it is. And man, what an important distinction that is.
Lee, what's your thoughts on this whole notion of the conservative media not or doing damage to their own cause the past few weeks, especially?
Well, I don't know. I don't know about the past few weeks. I would say it's in some ways it's been the past couple of years. But I think it's, you know, how deeply do you read? It's not that Fox miscalled the election. It's not that they get many major stories completely wrong. It's not. I mean, I think all those things are. They aggregate. And even for conservative readers and viewers, there comes a point where I think you have to engage with reality. And when you realize that the place where you're getting your information is giving you bad information time and time again, I think you begin to lose your audience. I also don't think, in honesty, that it helps, going back to Stewart, that they have become the punching bag of every late night comedian. And they like to say, oh, it doesn't matter. But people don't understand, because we don't very clearly articulate it, the relationship between journalism and popular culture. And there is one. There is that conversation about what the culture itself will tolerate. And yeah, they're on the losing end of that conversation.
Well, we did not get to our final topic. I will encourage you to go to our blog. We're talking about Bob Woodward and his dust up with the White House and whether or not he was actually threatened by Mr. Sperling, the economic advisor there, or not, and what that might mean about Woodward's current place in the journalism universe. But if you'd like to go to our blog, you can find a lot of links to those stories. But that's going to have to do it for us this week. I'd like to thank Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis for their comments. Thanks also to our technical team. You already know them. And also thanks to you for listening or watching. If you'd like to find out more, there are links on our blog. Just go to the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. You can also leave your questions, comments, or suggestions there. Or if you'd like, you can email them to us at views@kbia.org. I'm Mike McKean. We have a very special guest next week, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hedrick Smith. So join us Wednesday, March 13th, for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.